From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Pakistan says it foiled cross-border militant attack. Satellite imagery suggests future large North Korean rocket launch. Philippine president facing impeachment complaints, still defending his stimulus plan. These stories and more in this Thursday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Pakistan says it has repulsed an attack on a military outpost by Afghanistan-based militants, killing at least seven attackers. Ayaz Gul reports from Islamabad. The foreign ministry later summoned a senior Afghan diplomat to urge Kabul to take steps to stop border incursions by anti-Pakistan groups.
Army officials say a group of up to 80 terrorists invaded a border outpost in the northwestern Lower Deer district Tuesday night. They said Pakistani troops repulsed the raid and inflicted heavy casualties on the attackers. Pakistan's foreign ministry summoned a senior Afghan diplomat to lodge a strong protest about what it called another attack launched by terrorists from across the Afghan border. It urged the Kabul government to take effective steps to stop what it said was the use of Afghan soil for repeated cross-border fire and physical aggression against Pakistan. Speaking to VOA, a spokesman for the Afghan Foreign Ministry, Sirajul Haq Siraj, rejected the Pakistani claims. In turn, he criticized Islamabad for summoning the Afghan diplomat, alleging that such actions are meant to cover up repeated border violations originating from Pakistan.
Afghan government will not allow anyone to misuse the Afghan soil against its neighbors.
Tuesday's fighting occurred close to the Afghan provinces of Kunar and Nuristan, where Islamabad says fugitive anti-Pakistan militants have set up bases to stage cross-border attacks. The incident comes while Pakistani troops are conducting counter-insurgency operations in another border area further south, the tribal region of North Waziristan. Afghanistan has long asserted that the area serves as a training and recruiting ground for the Afghan Taliban insurgency. In a recent interview, Pakistani Army spokesman Major General Asim Bajwa told VOA the Waziristan offensive is aimed at eliminating all terrorists based there. He says Islamabad expects Kabul to take similar steps to uproot bases of the outlawed Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan or TTP on the Afghan side of the border.
The TTP sanctuary inside Afghanistan, especially the one in Kunar and Nuristan, we've been saying that again and again, those must be targeted by Afghans and they should either eliminate them or they should hand them over to Pakistan.
The two countries share a 2,500-kilometer mostly porous border and militants on both sides often launch cross-border attacks before going back. Pakistan and Afghanistan accuse each other's intelligence agencies of supporting these fighters to fuel insurgencies on their respective soils. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Later on Daybreak Asia, what pop culture teaches us about multiracial Asian Americans. Next week, a court in China will hear a high-profile case against two foreign business consultants charged with illegally obtaining personal information on Chinese citizens. Rebecca Valley reports from Hong Kong that the case highlights how authorities are increasing enforcement of China's privacy protections, making it difficult for companies to research potential business partners and investments.
On Tuesday, the Shanghai No. 1 Intermediate People's Court announced Briton Peter Humphrey and his American wife and business partner Yu Yingzeng will be tried on August 8. The couple is charged with having illegally obtained private information on Chinese citizens through their risk consultancy firm ChinaWise. According to its website, ChinaWise helped foreign companies avoid landmines in the Chinese market. That included background checks on business partners and employees, as well as anti-fraud investigations. Prosecutors alleged that a lot of the information the firm gathered over the years was illegally obtained, but from Chinese investigators or through secret photography, infiltration, or tailing after someone. But there is also speculation that the prosecution has political undertones. One of ChinaWise's most recent clients, pharmaceutical firm GlaxoSmithKline, had hired them to investigate a former employee, someone rumored to have powerful political connections. The British pharmaceutical giant wanted to know whether the employee had reported to senior management and the Chinese authorities evidence of widespread corruption at the firm. In an interview broadcast on state TV, Humphrey confessed to the charges and referenced the GSK job.
They said that...
在那次谈话中, 他的公司老总被举报。
His answer voiceover in Mandarin. Humphrey says the company requested him to investigate the background of the suspected informer and make an assessment of the informer. He offered to investigate GSK's China's internal businesses to determine if the alleged corruption did exist. But the company turned Humphrey down, he says. Chinese authorities started investigating the pharmaceutical company's practices in China last year, around the time Humphrey agreed to investigate the company's concerns over the alleged leak. In May, GlaxoSmithKline China executive Mark Reilly was formally accused of overseeing a network that bribed doctors to boost sales of the company's products. Instead of focusing only on the GSK job, Chinese prosecutors have charged Humphrey and Yu for information breaches that span many years. They include illegally obtaining and reselling phone, bank, and real estate records, businesses and vehicles registration, and other private documents. Attorney Steve Dickinson.
People are in China, and they want to know things about potential business partners. They want to know things about their commercial opponents. They want to know things about government officials. Well, great, but it's illegal to obtain that information. And so should it be illegal? That's a different question.
In recent years, authorities have updated provisions on privacy protection in an effort to avoid serious information breaches, says Liu Deliang, a professor of law at Beijing Normal University. He says that in December 2012, there's been a decision by the National People's Congress, which showed the importance that the new government in China put on information safety online. Obviously, there's been more awareness on the part of the public about the protection of their rights, Liu says. He believes that in the future, there will be more cases like this being discovered and prosecuted. But the breadth of some provision have raised concern the law might be used arbitrarily and could curb due diligence investigations such as the ones ChinaWise worked on. In an article Peter Humphrey wrote months before he was detained last year, Humphrey described a U-turn in his field. Companies' filings at local business bureaus were no longer accessible, and authorities have started arresting hundreds of investigators and their sources. I find this a very dark day for due diligence and forensic work, he wrote. Some analysts, including Humphrey, connected a clampdown on public records with foreign media investigations detailing the wealth of some of China's top leaders. Dickinson, who advises foreign companies about the Chinese market and is co-author of the China Law blog, says five foreign consulting firms he was familiar with got out of the business because of the apparent danger.
They saw all their contacts going to prison. And they said, well, we're next if we don't stop. So they stopped.
Daniel Rules, a mergers and acquisition lawyer at the law firm Squire Saunders in Shanghai, says that for years he advised potential foreign buyers to buy detailed reports on Chinese companies from a local firm.
There's a tremendous wealth of information available at a quite reasonable price. That company today is still in service, but it provides only the minimum information that's provided by the company register, the kind of information that any of us could get.
That, Rule says, is an example how the playing field has been changing in China. If found guilty, Humphrey and Yu face up to 3 years of prison. Rebecca Valley reporting for VOA News Hong Kong.
The U.S. Korea Institute has released satellite photographs indicating North Korea may be nearing completion of construction and testing, leading to long-range missile and satellite launches. Daybreak Asia's Victor Beatty reports the images were made public Tuesday as the top U.S. Navy Pacific commander cautioned the global community against indifference to the pace of the North's advances in nuclear and missile technology.
The U.S.-Korea Institute's 38 North website released satellite imagery Tuesday suggesting that activity at its Sohae satellite launching station means it's preparing for long-range ballistic missile and satellite launches. It says the height of the gantry for launches has been increased to over 50 meters and expects construction of an associated rail spur and road to accommodate larger rockets will be complete next year. The website says another series of tests of the KN-08 Road Mobile Intercontinental Ballistic Missile's first-stage rocket motor could end this year, although how successful those tests are remains a mystery. It also expects full-scale flight testing will be the next step. The KN-08 was unveiled during a military parade in Pyongyang in April 2012, although analysts were divided whether it was a mock-up rather than a real missile. In December of that year, the North sent a satellite into orbit on a multi-stage launch vehicle. Ralph Kosa, head of the Hawaii-based security think tank Pacific Forum, says if the report is accurate, it is a sobering development.
If they develop a road mobile missile that increases their offensive capabilities, increases the survivability of their nuclear force, so it's something I think we have to take very seriously.
Kosa, however, believes North Korea is a long way from having an operational long-range intercontinental missile with a nuclear warhead. At U.S. Defense Headquarters at the Pentagon Tuesday, the head of the U.S. Navy's Pacific Command, Admiral Samuel Locklear, said there is broad debate within the intelligence community about how much capability North Korea has to weaponize long-range missiles.
As a military commander, I have to plan for the worst, and I have to plan for, number one, what the North Koreans say they have, and they say they haven't, and what they demonstrate they might have when they show it to us. And so from those indications, then we have to ensure that we're properly postured to protect not only our own homeland, which includes all of our territories and the state of Hawaii, where I happen to be, but also that we're able to provide defense and security for our allies and our key partners in the region.
Locklear said he believes North Korea continues to make progress in both its nuclear and missile capability and that it will continue to want to do that. The admiral also expressed concern the global community is becoming numb to the amount of testing the North does. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Philippine President Benigno Aquino is fighting for his political career in the face of several impeachment complaints and approval ratings that have dipped to their lowest level since he took office 4 years ago. From Manila, Simone Orendain reports the controversy is over a government spending program, parts of which the High Court struck down this month.
Hundreds of protesters bearing colorful signs and banners snake their way toward the outer roads of the congressional building. They air their gripes, as they do each year before the president gives a national address at the start of the congressional session. But this year, New Patriotic Alliance Party Secretary General Renato Reyes says there is an impeachment complaint to back their displeasure.
It's really about holding the president accountable and having a platform to explain the issues to the people. So we're trying to explain to the people how funds are being used, why discretionary spending is really wrong, why the items in the DAP are not really beneficial to the people.
The Aquino administration created the DAP, or Disbursement Acceleration Program, in 2011. The idea was to fast-track public projects with money from other agencies that went unspent. But early this month, the Supreme Court ruled portions of the program unconstitutional. It said it was unconstitutional to take money out of budgets before the fiscal year ended, transfer it to branches of government beyond the office of the executive, and fund projects that were not covered by the general spending plan. Reyes and other critics call it the president's personal pork barrel fund, which is government funds that politicians use for local projects. They equate pork barrel spending with funds that are hard to account for and vulnerable to corruption. The administration's budget team, flanked by most of the president's cabinet secretaries, went before a Senate Finance Committee, which held a hearing on the DAP last week. In a mixture of Filipino and English, committee chairman Francis Escudero questioned DAP's status outside of general appropriations.
because it's difficult on the part of Congress to be proposed projects only to find out, although belatedly, halfway through the year.
He says it's difficult on the part of Congress to be proposed projects only to find out belatedly, halfway through the year, they won't be implemented, and then the funds are transferred to other projects that Congress does not even know about. Budget Secretary Florencio Abad defended the program, saying it was funded through savings that resulted in cutting practices vulnerable to corruption. Abad said it brought a dramatic improvement to economic growth. During his national address Monday, Aquino cited examples of how the quick funding helped the school system and disaster response efforts, among numerous other initiatives.
Alam po pong kaisa kayong mga nasa bulwagan.
He says, I know that those of you in this hall are one with me in believing that we must not deprive our countrymen of benefits and that these should reach them in the soonest possible time. This is why we are proposing the passage of a supplemental budget for 2014 so that the implementation of our programs and projects need not be compromised. The administration stopped the use of DAP and submitted a motion for reconsideration to the Supreme Court. Petitioners have been asked to respond. Ramon Casible heads the Philippine Institute for Political and Electoral Reform. He says the president is not vulnerable to the impeachment calls because the complainants simply do not have the votes in Congress. But Casible points out Aquino's ratings in two major surveys place him at 55% approval, significantly lower than the 60 and 70% he consistently enjoyed as recently as this year. Simone Orendain for VOA News, Manila.
The discussion of race in the United States has always been complex and often difficult. Yet, in an overwhelmingly large percentage of families, it's not too difficult to find at least some evidence of multiracial influence. Leilani Nashimi is Assistant Professor of Communications at the University of Washington and author of Undercover Asian. She examines how multiracial Asian Americans are often overlooked, even when presented in highly visible popular media, such as movies, television shows, magazine articles, and artwork. Nashimi contrasts the phenomenon with examples when audiences can view multiracial Asians as multiracial. Her fascinating study began with simple discussions in the classroom.
I had students in class who wanted to hear about mixed race, and so I taught one class on it. They liked it so much, I made it into a two-week unit. And they liked that so much, I turned it into a class. And after that, I thought, well, maybe this is enough there to write a book about. I mostly draw from pop culture and from visual culture specifically, so advertising, television, film, that sort of thing. That's partly just because of my own background and training. I was trained in literary studies, and I did most of my dissertation work on films. I'm also interested in popular cultural icons because I feel like they have something to say about our culture more generally. I feel like the reason that people become popular is because they tap into something that many of us can relate to. My particular interest was in mixed-race Asian Americans, partly because I think there's so many figures, I think, in popular culture, but they're so rarely recognized as being mixed-race Asian Americans, and I wanted to explore that more.
Tiger Woods certainly is one of the most recognized athletes around the world. And, of course, with some of the things that happened during Tiger's career in the past few years, made him even more well-known, I guess. Tiger is an interesting case. His father is African-American. His mother is Thai. And he pretty much calls himself an Asian-American.
Well, you know, it's a little ambivalent. Right? I mean, there's times, I think, where he identifies as African-American, sometimes as Asian-American. He had made up this term, Kablan Asian, for a while that he called himself. I think, though, for most of his career, he actually tries not to really identify racially at all. His publicity tends to paint him as something new, something outside of our usual racial categories.
You mentioned the color blindness aspect and how that can be potentially difficult for somebody like Tiger Woods.
To some ways, at the beginning of his career, it was a big advantage. And I think he really promoted himself as this kind of colorblind ideal, and it was very marketable. And so I think a lot of his advertising campaign really focused on him being this kind of new figure, this multiracial figure, colorblind figure. But I think that eventually there was too many expectations built up around it, so that when he got caught up in this scandal, it seems like a lot of that colorblindness kind of was revealed for being very flimsy and not really having much staying power. And so after the scandal, I think he was racialized very strongly, particularly as an African-American.
Science fiction has been very well known for integrating the races in various scenarios and storylines. You talk a little bit about race and science fiction in your book.
I love science fiction, so that was a sort of a natural choice for me. I see a lot of science fiction films. And I think, you know, science fiction is this really interesting space where people are able to have a utopia, have this kind of ideal of the world that they want to see. Often that's, I think, the overt story that we see on screen. Science fiction is still written by people who live in the world, same world we live in. So I think a lot of our unconscious beliefs about race still surface in those films in ways that aren't on the surface, right, that you might not recognize right away.
Are you surprised that there's so much dialogue about race at this point in our time? I mean, if you go back in virtually any family tree, you can find that families are multiracial.
That's right. And that's true for Asian Americans, too, which I think might be surprising for some people. We always are thinking about mixed race people as being something new and about Asian American interracial relationships as being something new. But that's been a part of U.S. Asian American history since Asian Americans have been here. I'm not surprised by the conversation. I'm actually a little surprised that there isn't more conversation. I think race is still a really big part of U.S. society, and there's so many taboos around talking about it that I think it actually suppresses some of the conversations that we might otherwise have.
One of the interesting topics I found in your book was multiracial genetics and the problem of geography. So often we tend to look at geographical areas for clues and answers to this discussion, but you say that it's really a poorly defined parameter.
The kind of sense that we have that geography can explain so much for us, I think, is partly because it seems like it exists outside of society or exists outside of culture. But a lot of the ways that we draw those boundaries between different continents or different geographical areas is really something that we've come up with socially rather than something that's existing naturally in the world.
It's incredibly complex and very emotional.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's also why it's so difficult to talk about. How can it be anything but personal? And so people feel very personal about their own racial identity, about feeling like they're going to say the wrong thing. I think that happens a lot. So we tend to not talk about it because we're not only worried that we're going to say the wrong thing, but that we're going to offend other people, that they're going to think badly of us because of the way we talk about race. So it's easier just not to say anything at all, at least in the short term. I think I would like for people to think about mixed race people as the beginning of a conversation, because there is this sense that mixed race people are something new and that they are a race of the future. I think a lot of times that shuts down conversation because we believe that we don't really actually have to do anything to improve racial relations, that we're inevitably heading towards this future where everyone's mixed. And I don't really think that's true. I think recognizing how long mixed race people have been with us and how enduring the racial groupings have been despite all this mixing can give us a way to start having a more robust conversation. You know, why is it that these racial groups continue to exist? Why is it so difficult for us to acknowledge or recognize mixed race Asian Americans in particular? Why do we still have these embedded stereotypical ideas about racial groupings?
Leilani Nashimi, Assistant Professor of Communications at the University of Washington and author of Undercover Asian, Multiracial Asian Americans in Visual Culture. Her book is published by the University of Illinois Press. Stay tuned. We've got much more for you right here on The Voice of America. It's the latest world news next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese, and then look for VOA News Chinese Edition. With this application, you can get the latest news and radio and TV programs in Chinese. It also lets you transfer photos and video directly to Washington. Go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese to get your free Chinese language iPhone app from VOA.